Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about state government and politics today. My guests are Karen Kassler. She's the Bureau Chief for Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for joining us, Karen.
Good morning.
And also Julie Carr Smythe. She is the Bureau Chief for the State House News Bureau of the Associated Press. Julie, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
There's a lot to talk about. We all have our lists. If our listeners would like to add to that list, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also get to us on Facebook at the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Let's just jump right into it with the anti-abortion bill. It was unveiled by Ohio Republican state lawmakers last week, right? Sets the stage for a Supreme Court fight that could jeopardize the decades-old precedent set by the nation's highest court. That I pulled from, I think, as an ABC News report. But really, does it have a chance to get through the Ohio General Assembly?
You know, it has 40 co-sponsors, which is interesting, and shows a little bit of the character of the new legislature.
40 out of 99.
Right. Republican dominated once again and not wasting any time. But my sense is it's more informing the debate. We have five or six other abortion bills already introduced. So the idea of this particular bill is that abortions would be outlawed once you could hear and detect the fetal heartbeat.
Which can be as early as?
It can be, I was told, 18 days. But generally, I think it's, 10, 12 weeks?
The thing that I've heard is about 5 weeks with certain technologies, but then about 10 weeks with others. So that's – I think Julie's absolutely right, though, that there's an issue here about how this is kind of framing the debate. Because the other bill – this particular so-called heartbeat bill is being – Ohio Right to Life is on record as saying they don't like it because they say it doesn't stand a chance of passing constitutional muster. They like a bill – that would ban abortions after a so-called viability point, which is about 20, 22 weeks, somewhere in that ballpark. So in a way, you could argue that the heartbeat bill makes the viability abortion bill look more moderate, look more reasonable. And I think that may be something of what's going on here, that you know, you're pushing the bar a little bit and changing where you think the line should be drawn, because certainly the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled, you know, that on different trimesters where abortions can happen, that they really have said the first trimester is kind of off limits, but the second and third, that's where the door has been open. And so I think there is an attempt to try to move this debate a little bit.
And what's interesting about a heartbeat bill is that the backers of this bill are looking at this as science. They're looking at the idea of you can use modern medical equipment to detect this. This is not a moral Christian religious debate anymore. This, we're right on board, folks, with the you know, the scientific angle on abortion, just as on the side of the pro-choice side, they've looked at things like, you know, preventing pregnancy and you know, birth control and that kind of thing. And so I think that this is the first time where they've really said, hey, you know, we've got them. I mean, in fact, Janet Folger said that to me pretty much for a quote.
Janet Folger, who was lobbying almost 20 years ago at the State House for the Ohio Right to Life.
And she's the head of a national group that's put this thing together. And they've really looked at Ohio, out of all the states that she's dealt with, they've looked at Ohio as being the best chance for this bill to go through. And she says that other states are watching to see what happens to this bill in Ohio. So they feel like they've got a good shot. But once again, I think, you know, even though you got 40 co-sponsors in the House, that doesn't guarantee anything. And I don't know if some people might feel that this is too extreme.
There's Republicans control every arm of state government now. Arguably, especially in the Ohio General Assembly, a more conservative brand of Republican is installed there now. Do any of these other bills that the heartbeat bill frames, do any of them, I mean, is it pretty clear that something, there are going to be more restrictions on abortions at the end of this 2-year session?
I think so. I think that the activists have decided that this is the time. This is the time to get something done that they want to get done. And I think they look at Ohio as being a great state to do that in, just because of exactly what you said. The Republicans control everything, and not just by one or two votes. I mean, they've got it all. And so the activists who are working on this, I think, have targeted Ohio and said, this is an area where we think we can win. Then we can take it up to the next court. I mean, because all these bills are going to be challenged immediately. As soon as they pass, they're going right to a courtroom, you know.
Right. And it's not going to just be on the procedure itself. I mean, some of these bills are looking to make it make parental consent more they're adding
more proof for
stiffening the amount of parental consent you have to have. They're banning, of course, the abortion funding out of public funds and so forth. So they're really looking not just at the procedure, but at everything around it that they can get at.
Which is what the states have the most rights to do.
Right.
Is everything outside of the actual procedure. And that's been going on for about 15 years now, since the Supreme Court ruled in that case. So 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guests are Karen Kassler. She's bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and also Julie Carr Smythe. She is the bureau chief for the State House Bureau of the Associated Press. You can also see us on Facebook if you want to go there. Jobs Ohio, how's that going? Remind us everything that it does. It's sweeping.
Yeah, the Jobs Ohio creates a new entity. It's a private nonprofit that would, or they're now calling it semi-private. But what's interesting about it is this economic development arm would be largely exempted from public records, open meetings, ethics, whistleblower, and disclosure laws. There are it's been softened somewhat in the Senate, that it blasted right through the House in a couple of days. And in the Senate side, they are looking to try to close some loopholes, including one that we wrote about that would have allowed travel paid for by third parties really to not be reported by the Jobs Ohio entity. So, for example, if you're not Kasich himself, who will still have to report, but say you're one of his designees, you could go on a trip paid for by a corporation that's on that board, and which will be appointed by the governor, and it wouldn't have shown up.
And right now, let's say you work for the Ohio Department of Development in their jobs development section, and you're going on a, you know, a trip overseas with a group of business people. One of them, you're not allowed to have one of those business people pay for your trip.
Right.
Right.
Right. And I mean, the thing is, these things are a little squishy public records wise, even now, because obviously there are proprietary things. There are business deals being cut.
Already those proprietary laws are in place,
right,
aren't they?
Right. So but this is the position of the administration at this point is that this is being treated as any other nonprofit. In other words, the IRS could come in and audit it if they want. A nonprofit has its own rules and regulations. It's not necessarily a public entity with public records.
And I think there's an idea of selling this as, hey, it's not like the Department of Development as it exists right now is giving up all the information. If you tried to ask what the Department of Development is doing right now to bring jobs here or deal with this one company or whatever, it's not like they're telling everything to us all the time. And so I think there are some Republicans who are saying, hey, our rules are not going to be that much different than the rules that already exist. But there are a lot of people, and Julie and I are probably among them, who are a little suspicious that, you know, maybe the rules are going to be different. And certainly when you're changing from a completely governmental agency into this nonprofit public-private partnership thing, you are changing the rules. And there are going to be some things that we're going to ask questions about that we're just going to be told you don't get to know that information.
Right. And I did a look at this because it was a promise of Kasich's on the campaign trail. And I did a look at this before the election. And across the country, it has a bit of a spotty record in terms of this accountability issue. And I think that's why the press corps here is really hammering on this because, for example, in Florida, you know, some high percentage of the actual business deals that were cut went to those who were involved in the board. In another state, you know, they did not have to report and the CEO was taking all kinds of jet trips.
Let's talk about the structure of it because we're – Governor Kasich would be the chairman of the board. Mm-hmm. There'd be this board of designees that would be successful business people, blah, blah, blah.
He said CEOs and executives.
He says we'll know who they are. We'll be impressed. So
yes, and they'll be big shots. And then there's going to be this bureaucracy beneath them that actually does the legwork, is out there, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's, and they bring them to this board three or four times a year. Was it quarterly or something like that? And the board kind of has this big,
right,
you know.
And those meetings are supposed to be public. The four times a year meetings,
right,
are supposed to be public.
It's all the behind the scenes stuff. And the people that will be working for the board, are those the people that are going to be getting the big bonuses and
right,
that they're talking
yeah,
about? And,
so
or
the,
bonuses. We don't know how big they'll be. Maybe they'll be abject failures and get nothing. But, right, the, you know.
Right. Exactly. And actually, it will be that way. If they're abject failures, they'll be fired. And if they're doing well, they'll get bonuses.
But how will we know if they are abject failures? And
well,
whether the people getting fired or, you know, how will that be what kind of accountability will they have to the public on that score?
This is to be determined by a contract which would be cut between the new board that Kasich appoints and the existing Department of Development, which will not go away now at this point. They've decided they'll keep that and it'll be the state entity that these things go through. But certainly those employees will be on a – it's either a quarterly or an annual report. We'll know their names, we'll know their salaries, we'll know their bonuses probably once a year. One of the things that I found in other states is that they did occasionally inflate the job numbers in order to qualify for that bonus. And so that's another thing where the reporting is just going to be very important and the doggedness of the Iowa Press Corps to make sure that, you know, those things match up and that there aren't empty fields where there are supposed to be jobs.
What about the other functions of the Ohio Department of Development? Will they be just left behind and they'll still be this Department of Development? Or is the legislation also divvy up those other things like tourism,
sure,
and those kind of things?
Well, I think, you know, there's this whole idea still of streamlining government and dealing with as many agencies as the state has and that sort of thing. And I think there are a lot of functions that happen in the Department of Development that don't necessarily relate to job creation, such as the winterization program and things like this. And so there's going to have to be a decision made on whether those programs stay with development, whether they go somewhere else, and do you want to put some of those programs in other agencies that already have plenty to do, like I'm thinking Job and Family Services, you know. So I don't know what's going to happen to those, and that's going to be something I think that we're going to see as this goes through. But I think that's one reason why Jobs Ohio does not dismantle the Department of Development. There's a lot of stuff going on there that needs to be dealt with and figured out. Where do we put this program? Where do we put that one?
Right, community development block grants, yeah, and the HEAP energy, I think you mentioned. But, so those are the kind of things that maybe would be in a renamed, you know, community development department.
Now, when they redid Ohio Jobs and Family Services, that was at least a two-year effort, wasn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah.
I wasn't covering the legislature at the time, but it seems it took 2 years. But then to actually implement it,
right?
It took,
and it's now a massive agency. I mean, it's the state's largest agency, 3,700 employees
combined. Was about what it was before Human Services and Ohio Bureau of Employment Services.
And that's the kind of thing that some who are opposed to these merging of state agencies have said is why it doesn't work, because you create these massive state agencies that have a lot of bureaucracy, that have a lot of people working for them, and you can't get the direct one-on-one answers and that sort of thing. So I think this whole streamlining government thing is going to come up again, but I think it's probably going to be after this budget because, I mean, my gosh, how are you going to do this all? Already right now, we have the budget, we have this collective bargaining, we've got these abortion bills, we've got Jobs Ohio, we've got all these things on the table. It's just, you get to the point where you think, how are they going to get all these things done in this short a period of time? And we're only in February.
I'm exhausted already. We have to take a break. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guests are Karen Kassler of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and also Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press, 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call and have a question or comment for us, you can email us as well at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
You're listening to 89.7 NPR News. At 2 o'clock, Talk of the Nation begins. And if you talk to a college freshman today, you'll find out something interesting. They thought college would be harder. What college students are learning, that's a discussion on Talk of the Nation this afternoon. The program is here from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting the off-Broadway solo work Let Me Down Easy by Anna Deavere Smith, star of Nurse Jackie in the West Wing, February 22nd through the 27th at the Lincoln Theater. Tickets at wexarts.org.
32 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, a high of 41 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 34. There's a slight chance of rain for Wednesday, but warmer, a high of 51 degrees. Sunshine as we look ahead to Thursday, and a high of 60 degrees. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guests this hour, Julie Carr Smythe of the Associated Press and also Kieran Kassler of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We're talking about state government politics. So if you have a question or comment for us along that line, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've talked about the anti-abortion bills in the Ohio General Assembly. We've also talked about the Jobs Ohio. We just finished talking about that. One final question I had about Jobs Ohio, though, and we can continue talking about it if you want, because it's a big deal. It's a top priority for the governor. Mark Kwame, the director of the Ohio Department of Development, is only going to be around for about 6 months. And I was wondering if anybody has a sense, you know, the clock is ticking. Now it's 5 months. He's working for a buck a year or something like that. Ridiculous. He's a very successful. What does that say about it if you have somebody coming in for just 6 months? Is that normal?
Well, I think that he is well-versed in this sort of business creation. He's a venture capitalist, and I think that Kasich is looking at it as this is a business model that Kwame is uniquely qualified to put in place. He can make some hard decisions, a little like, you know, somebody who comes in and shifts everything around and then leaves. He doesn't have to build those relationships, but he can be also brutally honest because he isn't a long-termer. He's not politically entrenched here in Ohio.
Has he made much of an impression so far?
I think so. At least at the State House, I think he's come forth, answered some tough questions, and delivered the main testimony on the Jobs Ohio bill in both chambers. And I think he was really quick on his feet. He knew the answers. He knew what he wanted to say. That was my impression. Mm-hmm. Okay. I take it he's spending a lot of his time on the road talking to people, maybe cutting deals or helping Kasich in that way. I know he went on the trip to Detroit where they talked with the automakers.
Yeah, right. Where they breathed a sigh of relief.
A lot of these questions that we have about some of the stuff are going to be resolved pretty soon. I mean, like Julie said, this thing powered through the House. It's up in the Senate committee today. It'll probably go to the full Senate tomorrow.
Really?
So,
the full Senate tomorrow? Well, that's and like grease lightning in the Senate, too.
Isn't it amazing that, you know—
For the Senate, that's scary fast.
Well, it's funny, and I'm not trying to, make any judgments on the previous legislature, because obviously it was an election year.
And
so
they
passed
10 bills in 2 years or something like that?
It is amazing when you look at how fast things are moving when everybody wants them to move quickly and nobody's back in their districts, fundraising and doing the hard work that they have to do to run for office. It's the lightning speed of some of these things is just amazing to me.
And my take on that politically is just the writing is on the wall now that in this country, every 2 years, there's going to be a changeover, an upheaval. And Republicans, they have the Capitol now in this state and in many states, as well as in Washington, and they're not wasting any time in either place. I think they know the time is short.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, exactly the same thing, but I'm wondering also how some voters are going to see this. Like, for the example, this collective bargaining bill. This thing is getting a lot of attention, and this may be going too far for some people. I mean, some polls have shown that Ohioans don't want this kind of dramatic change that this bill would bring, and you even have some conservative Republicans who are saying this thing goes a little further than we're comfortable with. So I just wonder if there might be a backlash at some point if they do pass certain things that maybe some people might think went too far. And so in 2 years, are some of these folks going to be turned right back around again because they went beyond what voters apparently decided they wanted?
If the opposition can enunciate things properly, it makes you wonder. Now, granted, the Senate's been controlled by the Republicans for, well, since 1989 or since 1990 or something like that, and solidly controlled more than ever. But when you talk about getting things done and understanding the upheaval every 2 years, it makes you question, well, what about Ted Strickland, who was governor for 4 years, and the House was controlled by the Democrats, pretty well covered in the House. Did they miss an opportunity, or with the Senate being controlled like by the Republicans, there wasn't as much opportunity?
I think there wasn't as much opportunity, but I think if you really look at it, I mean, he managed to do a lot. For example, executive orders weakened strengthened the ability of certain state groups to unionize. He did prevailing wage reforms just administratively on paper.
He got that income tax cut delay, tax hike, whatever you want to call it. And that was something that Republicans came out of that negotiation saying, it's a tax hike. We don't want it, but we'll do it. I mean, so in a way, Governor Strickland did a lot. Now, some of it's being turned back around. Like, for example, his evidence-based reform education model is getting ready to be, completely dismantled. But he did get a fair amount of things done, especially in dealing with the Senate, which, as you said, was very solidly Republican.
Have we heard anything about what the governor is going to do about the exotic pets or the pact with the Humane Society and the agricultural community?
Kasich has said he doesn't, on the surface, oppose that agreement. And as of right now, he doesn't plan to dismantle it. He's going to honor it for now.
But he's also said that he's concerned that if the Humane Society of the United States is not happy and they want to come back in and, renegotiate or put a ballot issue on, he's concerned about, as he calls it, the pressure of outside groups on state government. And what happens in Ohio should not be determined by what a national organization says. So he's even suggested at that point that maybe the idea of changing the way that ballot issues get put before voters might happen at some point, which is, again, a whole other.
That would have to be constitutional.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it?
And once again, we have all these other things that are right here that are huge, to put that one out there. But yeah, Julie's right. He hasn't really talked about it that much because, we've got a couple other things that
he's got other fish to fry. One of them, what he's frying right now these days is organized labor and particularly labor agreements with state workers.
It's this collective bargaining bill,
Senate Bill 5,
which is interesting because normally you don't have bills referred to by number because nobody knows what they are once you get out of the state house. But you have people that are saying, oh, Senate Bill 5, we have to stop this, or Senate Bill 5 is an important bill or whatever. So there's a lot being talked about on this bill because, there are a lot of unions that would be affected by it, state as well as local and local
county,
communities.
Municipal, right.
You've got teachers, firefighters, all these groups that would be affected by this. So there's a lot of conversation. And on the other side, you have a lot of people, Tea Party groups and these sorts of groups that are saying that they want this bill to pass. So later this week, there's going to be a convergence of these two groups with very different agendas coming to the state house to push their case. So this Thursday could be a very interesting day.
Well, speaking of taking is this something that could happen? I mean, could Senate Bill 5,
Like I said,
could they dismantle collective bargaining
as
we know it?
I don't think it's going to pass because I think you have some Republicans who feel it goes too far. And these are not necessarily people who are friends of labor unions, but people who just feel like this is not the battle for right now, that this is too much too soon, and maybe it ought to be put off for a little while longer, that the idea is good to get it out there, but this bill does too much. But unfortunately, John Kasich has said, well, if this bill doesn't pass, and this bill doesn't even do some of the things he wants to do, he wants to continue on with this. So right. This is not over.
Right. And interestingly enough, I just came from a press conference by some labor representatives at the local city, county level. And one of the women there who had been involved since the 70s was talking about how former Governor George Voinovich was actually a master of using collective bargaining to his advantage, to getting together with the unions and really taking them on tours and showing them how the private sector worked and working with them in partnership to bring those kind of reforms.
And he also
took
them off a few times. I mean, with the private prisons that were opened in Ohio while he was in office, and also with the privatization of the liquor stores, that kind of a thing. He wasn't all budsy-wudsy all the time. He didn't kowtow to them, but the idea of eliminating collective bargaining in a state like Ohio would be monumental. It's been around for how many years now? Since the 60s or something like that?
Yeah, it's a sea change. It really would be. And, you know, the people that would be affected, and you know, we're talking like we've been saying, a local, state, I mean, individuals as well as communities. And
Republicans and Democrats
alike.
Yeah,
it's a massive undertaking. And
I think 3,000 contracts are in place in this state involving
tens of
thousands of
people. Let's talk about the whole issue of, well, I want to do hear from Governor Kasich right now, talking about jobs and the budget in Toledo last week. But I also want to talk about how often do union workers actually strike.
It's not very often.
Even schools.
Very rare. My TV show, The State of Ohio, which airs on WSU TV, I had a panel of education leaders talking about some of these issues. And the guy from the Ohio Education Association was saying, you know, in the 26 years, I think, that since this bill's been in place, there have been 27 teacher strikes. Before that, there were over 300. And the real issue, too, was that, you know, there used to be no notice that teachers would just go on strike.
Right.
And, you know, the kids would be in the classroom and there'd be no teachers. And now with collective bargaining and the different rules that are in place, that, you know, there are now procedures and it's a little bit more, you know, solid and it's not as chaotic as it was before. You know, but that's a guy from a teachers union who's saying this. So.
Right. And Kasich has said he wants to make it impossible to strike. He's also said he doesn't much care for binding arbitration. So, you know, it sort of raises the question, how do you come to an agreement at that point?
We have an email from Jesse. They write, it seems to me that the Tea Party swing for smaller government is manifested in Ohio as a puritanical, control-based set of laws. Combine that with the anti-union actions, and I fear we might become more red than Texas. Let's hear from Governor Kasich. Last week, he continue to talk about the upcoming budget. His version is due in mid-March, and here he's talking to Rotarians in Toledo.
You might say, well, what do you do with a budget? Well, every single program goes under the microscope. Do we need it? Can we privatize it? Can we improve it? Can we combine it? No politics, folks. There is no political considerations in any of this.
So he went on to discuss the big public employee, you know, union busting theme of his administration. But so how does that fit into saving money? I mean, does he talk about how it actually saves money?
Well, it's an extremely good question because we don't know that any of these, well, certainly most of these contracts cannot be revisited in time for this budget cycle, for one thing. Many of these unions are not state unions. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about thousands of little townships, school districts, and et cetera, that really their salaries don't affect the state budget. However, I think that the premise here is that those salaries, negotiated salaries, are a big piece of government expense in the state of Ohio as a whole.
The point has been made, though, that you could fire every state worker and still come up with what? $2 billion, $4 billion, whatever it is, but not even touch the $8 to $10 billion that's out there in terms of the deficit that's coming up. So the idea that this will save a lot of money immediately, as Julie says, is just – it doesn't hold water. But, you know, long term, does it save money? That's kind of the issue that needs to be discussed. And, you know, I think that the cut that you just played of Kasich is interesting. Every program has to go under the microscope. You know, it's funny.
It takes time.
Yeah. And, and it's funny, but when you ask lawmakers, okay, how about this program? How about this program? Which ones? We're not getting the answers. Oh, this program, this program. You know, we're looking at getting rid of this thing. You know, it's very frustrating right now as we're trying to figure out, okay, what might be coming up in the budget, which is due a month from today. What might be putting together? What might we see? And, you know, if everything's on the table, well, what does that mean? What is everything?
Right. And what does that amount to?
Exactly.
And one of the things that's important to for your listeners to think about as they're watching this coverage on this issue is the public sector, yes, does have on average, higher salaries. Reason being, more of these jobs are actually at a college-educated type level. There are a lot of lawyers, a lot of teachers. If you look at the private sector as a whole and you average that salary, you're looking at every McDonald's worker, you know, every Walmart greeter, every, you know, buddy all the way up and down the spectrum. So you really need to look at apples to apples in terms of, okay, compare a private sector lawyer to a public sector lawyer. You know, you got to compare what the job is and what the salary is. So what we're seeing right now, and it's hard to even reference, but we're seeing a lot of the studies that are showing this comparison, public versus private. And the reason none of them are matching up is that you have to decide what it is that you're exactly looking at.
And some of these public sector jobs don't have a counterpart in the private sector.
Right.
I mean, you know, police officers, it's, you know, a security guard is not the same as a police officer. Prison guards, it's, you know, you have private prisons, but it's a little bit different. So Julie's right. It's these studies, you know, do show that. But I think unions also have the job of trying to figure out how to take this information and work it on their end, because I think a lot of people have a bad impression of public employees, that they do get a lot of time off or they don't have to save for their retirement or this, that, and the other thing. And many of these things aren't true. But I think a lot of people do have these impressions out there. And that's a little bit of what's fueling this collective bargaining bill. But again, I think that bill for a lot of Republicans goes too far.
Yeah, and I think that we're starting to see even this morning with this news conference I went to, the strategy of let's try to say this isn't partisan. This isn't Republicans versus Democrats. This is working people versus Governor Kasich. I mean, that's the sort of the rhetoric that's coming through now on that side. And I'm sure they're going to try a variety, but that's today's message is, you know, that's how they're going to frame it for today.
Well, ostensibly, it isn't Republican or Democrat, because I said before, there's plenty of county and local governments out there that are controlled by one or the other party, and Republicans, too, that will be affected by this immediately, you know, would be immediately affected by it. So it really isn't. We have to take another break. There's lots more to talk about. Stay with us. If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back with Kieran Kassler of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Julie Carr-Smythe. She is the Bureau Chief of the Associated Press at the State House. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
British singer-songwriter P.J. Harvey relied on first-hand accounts of war to write the songs for her new album of war songs called Let England Shake. On the next Fresh Air, we hear some of that music and talk with P.J. Harvey. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on 89.7 NPR News. Where did the first living thing on Earth come from? Watch WOSU-TV Wednesday night as Nova Science Now journeys back in time to the birth of our solar system to examine whether the key to our planet's existence might have been the explosive shockwave of an ancient supernova. Also, learn how head lice are offering clues about our evolution. Watch Nova Science Now Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
33 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today. The high should reach 41 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight and a low of 34. There's a slight chance of rain for Wednesday, but warmer with a high of 51. Looking ahead to Thursday, partly sunny skies and even warmer, a high of 60 degrees for Thursday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are Julie Carr-Smythe. She's the Bureau Chief for the Associated Press at the State House. Welcome back, Julie.
Thanks.
And also Karen Kassler. She's Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio's State House News Bureau. Karen, thanks again for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Let's hear from, this goes back a little bit, but because of our fundraiser and, membership drive and that kind of stuff, I haven't been able to talk about it yet, but that would be the governor's cabinet, and let's hear from Stephen Colbert and his February 3rd show. Here, Ohio Governor John Kasich had made it into the national spotlight earlier in February on the Colbert Report, and the host, Stephen Colbert, referred to the makeup of the governor's cabinet.
I celebrate a hero of black history, Ohio Governor John Kasich, who has stirred the passions of the Ohio black community.
Ohio Governor John Kasich has appointed nearly two dozen cabinet members, and so far, not one is African American or Hispanic.
We pick people on the basis of who's qualified. We don't pick them on the basis of quotas.
Yeah, he's just putting together the best possible team, like the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, if they were all the white one.
Of course, Stephen Colbert goes on and on and on with that, actually devoted quite a bit of attention to it. I know the governor met with the Black Caucus from the Ohio House, I think, or anyways, Ohio General Assembly. Tell us what's going on. And he's actually appointed an African-American to his cabinet.
And he was
as well.
Actually supposed to be speaking this morning, or as we speak, I think, to the Black Caucus luncheon.
Okay.
He met with the Black Caucus yesterday. Mm-hmm. He met with at least three senators in the last week who had some concerns. And it sounds like there's some, discussion happening, but whether there'll be any changes made, I can't imagine. I mean, he did appoint Michael Colbert.
That is just so unfair.
I completely crashed mentally on those two names there, to head Job and Family Services, which was a really interesting appointment because, again, Job and Family Services is the state's largest agency, likely to take the biggest hits in the budget. And even the Black Caucus members say, this is the constituency that we represent is served in many ways by Job and Family Services. So to have an African-American heading that agency and making the case for the agency at a time when budget cuts are going to be pretty devastating is really important. But they're obviously not satisfied. One appointment out of 23 is for many.
No,
not
no Latinos, no Hispanics,
two women,
a few women, no Asians, no Asian Indians. I mean, just it's other than that.
Right. Interestingly enough, too, Colbert, who was is our black cabinet member, was the deputy there before the interim. Mm-hmm. And the guy, Doug Lumpkin, who ran that agency, got hired by John Husted.
Secretary of State, yeah.
Who, yes, is the Secretary of State and also an aspiring gubernatorial candidate. So it's been interesting to watch what may be going on there in terms of this issue. The other two things you should find interesting are that John Kasich has made an issue over a black member of the state school board. He has also championed a woman in Akron, a mother who mm-hmm. enrolled her children in an adjacent school district and was an unrelated records tampering charge, was convicted of a felony. Both these women were black. I think that he is taking the chance here to show himself by he actually filled the state school board job with a black Asian woman. Mm-hmm. And I think he's trying to put himself out there as, hey, you know, it's not all what you think you're hearing about my cabinet.
And arguably the issue over – he's asked the parole board to determine whether the felony conviction of that woman who used her father's address to enroll her children in a neighboring school district was an appropriate punishment. And arguably he's also making a case for school choice.
Oh, yeah. And that's the appointment to the state school board. Same deal. This is a woman – the appointee that he added, Angela Thee Bennett, is definitely a proponent of school choice. The person who – was in a way evicted, though they will make the argument that she was never confirmed and so that she really didn't have a seat past the end of last year, was a special education teacher in the Cleveland schools for 35 years and a member of one of the two teachers unions. So, yes, yeah, school choice, he's definitely using both of these situations as opportunities to push forward the idea of school choice.
614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment for us. Also, an ancillary issue that's popped up in the past week is how many of the directors in John Kasich's cabinet are beneficiaries of the double dipping provision in you know, that they're allowed to do, where they've retired from one public sector job and now are getting employed by another public sector, another job, and can get both their retirement.
Well, I mean, you look at like Jerry Ray, the director of ODOT. He was
around.
The director of ODOT before. So,
right.
You know,
he's a double dipper.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess we can't say that for certain, but yeah, probably. But yeah, I mean, when you bring back names of people who have been around, that's something that, you know, may or may not be an issue. And there's another area where I think the unions have not really tried to fight back. The idea of double dipping is so abhorrent to some people that it's just a horrible waste of money. But unions will say, hey, it's not a waste of money if you really look at certain cases. You know, you hire some people back and it's not costing any more money or whatever. So I think there's an area where people get angry because, you know, there's one side of an issue being put out there and maybe another side is also being overlooked.
Right. But it is true that there are a number within his cabinet that are coming back. His prisons director, obviously, Tom Charles, the mm-hmm. public safety oh, yeah. director, moved from the IG. And probably was just stayed on. I don't know that Tom Charles is double dipping.
Maybe there should be an investigation.
But interestingly enough, when you talk about that issue, at the end of the last General Assembly, Ted Strickland made this large group of appointments. Most of what that's been used for in the past historically is for those whose party lost in the election who are wanting to be part of the state retirement system and needing to keep continuous service. And the Republicans booted these appointees all out in what looked to be pretty unprecedented from what we could tell down mm-hmm. at the State House. But now we're seeing him very forcefully, you know, filling some of these jobs, like the state school board job, which was not even one of the ones that was created by that move.
Well, and governors for years have wanted to have more control on that State Board of Education. Now, I'm going all the way back to Voinovich. They wanted more of their appointees on that board. So this is definitely an opportunity as Governor Kasich is thinking about, you know, what he wants to do with education and dismantling the evidence-based model, you know, having more of his people on the board who will then pick a new school superintendent. You know, all these things kind of factor into that.
And he has an education czar or whatever you want to call it. Too.
He right. does, but he does not, you know, Deb DeLisle, who's the state superintendent, right. Serves at the pleasure of that board, and that board is part elected, part appointed, and, you know, part regional and part central. And so, you know, I think he's trying to exercise some muscle there and get more influence, maybe even push her out. I don't know whether he can, but.
Well, eventually, once she's up for reappointment, how long do we know how long her contract is? I don't.
I have
so much to keep track of.
I know. And that's no excuse. And so I should just be beaten about the head and shoulders for that. I'm sorry.
Well, eventually she will be. So the estate tax, the death tax, how is that faring in the Ohio General Assembly now? They want to repeal the death tax in Ohio.
Right. And I think there's a potential change of that coming that would kind of delay the effect of it, that if it passes this year, it would delay it for 2 years because you have local mayors and county commissions and groups that are just really upset about this because it does 80% of the revenue from the estate tax does go to local entities.
And some local entities more than others.
Well,
otherwise,
sure.
If you're from a very wealthy community where there are a lot of wealthy people
right.
who would fall into this category because not everybody does. It's what, $300,000 or
$338,000
$338,000 or above. More communities
right.
than others.
Right. But these communities have said, hey, this has been our budgeting for many years and to just yank it out from under us. At the same time, you're talking about cutting state funding in other areas. It's just not fair. And, you know, the lawmakers who are pushing this estate tax repeal have now said, we'll give you another 2 years. Once it passes, it won't take effect until 2013. So there, you got 2 years to figure out how you're going to do your budgets without any estate tax money. And so it's I think it's going to go through. And if it doesn't go through, there's a group that has talked about taking it to the ballot because they think they've got the popular support that would get it passed if the legislature doesn't do it.
Because most people are not affected by this.
Well, and the evidence is,
to a great degree.
The evidence is pretty spotty as to whether – I mean, the main argument is that this drives people out of the state, that people get older who are wealthy. They want to leave the state and defect somewhere else because
like
they,
Florida,
right,
or
because they don't want to spend their they don't want all of their money going to a tax after they die.
And I don't know about the idea that it doesn't affect most people because $338,000 is pretty low when you start thinking about land, property, houses, you know, overall life acquisition. You know, if you got a farm. I mean, you may not be a well-off farmer, but your land may be worth $338,000. And so that's what the estate tax people the people who support the repeal are saying, that this does not just affect, you know, Les Wexner. This affects people way down below that line. And you've got some groups who see the writing on the wall that the estate tax is going to be repealed who are saying, instead of repealing it, why don't you move that threshold and just really, you know, move it up to $500,000 or move it up to $1 million.
Right, modernize it.
Right. Could you say, for instance, you can't tax – this tax doesn't apply to private – to real estate ostensibly? I mean, are there ways that they could monkey with it?
I think that that's one of the things that they're thinking about is are there ways to soft pedal it a little from a complete removal of this tax to some sort of compromise? Like Karen says, you know, one thing would be a slower phase in, but then also exemptions to it. And I also don't think that we're going to see it come through as a standalone bill. I really think that it'll get it'll hang out there until the budget comes through because most big tax stuff needs to be in that budget proposal.
OSU President Gordon Gee has already said they're going to increase tuition. They fully expect to get cuts from the state. What do we know or anything we know about the governor's feelings about higher education and how it might fare in the coming budget? Everything's on the table.
Everything's on the table.
Everything's going under the microscope. Okay.
So it's a big honking microscope, by the way. I would think that, yeah. I think most of the higher education people I've talked to have said that they're pretty much prepared for big hits, you know, in the higher education area. And you know, when you have to start talking about where to cut, do you cut primary education? Do you cut higher education? You know, if you're going to cut both, which one gets it worse? And I think it's going to be a rough couple of years for people who are in college or saving for college.
At the same time, I do think that we'll see some synergies there. Gordon Gee, again, was on that trip, I believe, was it to Toledo? Where, I mean, some of the governor's been going around doing some economic development PR and negotiation, and Gordon Gee has been with him. I think the University of Toledo president came with him too, and I think that he wants to definitely do the engine of R&D type thing, which already I think got started under, well, really, Taft and then the Third Frontier and then on through Strickland. So I think that that role will just be honed.
Yeah, that partnership idea of stuff that's research that is done at universities that companies can build on that or use that in some way. And I think you're going to see a lot of those kind of partnerships because it's an interesting idea, you know.
The Cincinnati Inquirer wrote about the revenue from casinos. And even though none of them have opened up yet, the revenue is shrinking, or the anticipated revenue. What's going on there?
Yeah, this is really interesting. And Kasich has said he would not be against the idea of sort of throwing some of his muscle behind a revision of the terms of that casino deal, which may require going back to the Constitution. But what I think that article pointed out was that the even right now they're looking at the projections for how many people would visit those casinos and thinking those would be ultimate. If I'm reading it right, those would be ultimate user numbers and not first year or second year numbers, which means that, again, whatever the budgeteers downtown are trying to put together is not going to have as much from casinos as we thought.
And I think that's what the opponents had argued from the very beginning, that this is a shrinking market, that there was a lot of stuff out there, that Ohio was too late to the game, all these things. And what I'm interested to see happening on the gambling front is whether there are going to be electronic slot machines allowed at horse racing tracks, which is something that Governor Strickland had tried to do to balance the budget 2 years ago and got shot down. And there was going to be a ballot issue and all this stuff. And so now that issue may come up again. It comes up before the legislature, what, once every 3 or 4 years?
For 20-odd years.
But you've got a possible Beulah Park in the owners of Beulah Park moving their Beulah Park and one of their other tracks to other cities, I think Dayton
and
Youngstown.
Dayton, which would compete with another track around Dayton.
And then you've got another, the group that tried to do that Wilmington Casino a couple years ago. They want to open a racino, so to speak, in Youngstown. But they need the VLTs to really make that a possibility. So I'm interested to see what the legislature does with those electronic slot machines.
Right, and to find out was, could their opposition to Strickland have been political? I don't know.
It's not going to involve politics, though.
No, nothing is political.
Nothing's going to involve
it's
politics.
Not politics.
We just have about 30, 45
seconds.
Gosh,
we're jaded, aren't we? Golly.
30, 45 seconds to kind of wrap up the whole prisons reform effort.
So yeah, okay. So basically, prisons are really expensive. We're going to have to reform sentences and put more people in less expensive places, especially nonviolent offenders. They're looking at ways to bring them maybe out into the community sooner, maybe even not send them in the first place, because the 1 year, the person who goes in for a year or less is the most expensive.
And they get
the
less chance of reforming.
Right. They don't even have time to get into a class or a program because they're in there and out of there so quickly.
And three branches of government behind this particular prison reform
Everybody
proposal.
But
the prosecutors say they're a little bit concerned about some of the things that would allow for early release and earned credit and that sort of thing. So
a bunch of stuff that they abolished, 10 years ago.
Yeah, they say that some of the stuff does not go along with truth in sentencing. So, you know.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time. Sorry to squeeze that in. I guess we'll have to do talk again. My guest, Julie Carr Smythe, the Bureau Chief for the Associated Press at the State House Bureau. Thanks for joining us, Julie.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And also Kieran Kassler. She's the Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Kieran, as always, thank you.
No, you're welcome. Thanks.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the Central Ohio Trauma System, working with community partners to make Central Ohio a safer place to live. Details about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation and supporting the Central Ohio Trauma System are at goodhealthcolumbus.org.